When panic attacks, the world narrows to a terrifying pinpoint. Your heart races, breathing becomes shallow, and catastrophic thoughts flood your mind. But what if these debilitating experiences could be overcome without medication? This is the revolutionary premise behind Dr. David Byrne's approach to treating anxiety. As a psychiatrist who has helped thousands overcome anxiety disorders, Burns challenges the conventional wisdom that anxiety requires pharmaceutical intervention. His methods have garnered praise from celebrities like Jennifer Aniston, who credits cognitive techniques for helping her manage anxiety, and have influenced modern therapy worldwide. Research backs his claims. Studies show that 2/3 of depressed patients who read his earlier book, Feeling Good, recovered without additional treatment. What makes Byrne's approach so powerful is its simplicity. By changing your thoughts, you can change your feelings. This book isn't just another self-help manual. It's a comprehensive toolkit that has transformed the treatment of anxiety disorders and continues to influence how therapists approach emotional suffering decades after its initial publication. I think, therefore, I fear. This twist on Descartes' famous statement captures the essence of the cognitive model, the foundation of Byrne's approach to treating anxiety. The model rests on three simple but profound ideas. You feel the way you think. When you're anxious, your thoughts are distorted. And when you change your thinking, you change your feelings. Consider what happens when you feel anxious. Your mind isn't neutral. It's actively telling you something terrible is about to happen. These catastrophic thoughts trigger physical symptoms like rapid heartbeat and shallow breathing, which then reinforce more negative thoughts, creating a vicious cycle. The key difference between healthy fear and neurotic anxiety is that healthy fear stems from valid perceptions of danger, while anxiety comes from distorted thoughts disconnected from reality. These distorted thoughts follow predictable patterns that Burns calls cognitive distortions. Fortune-telling involves predicting disaster without evidence. I'll definitely fail this interview. Mind-reading assumes others are judging you negatively. Everyone at this party thinks I'm boring. All or nothing thinking sees situations in black and white terms. If I'm not perfect, I'm a complete failure. Overgeneralization transforms a single negative event into an endless pattern. I always mess up important opportunities. Mental filter focuses exclusively on negatives while ignoring positives, while magnification/minimization exaggerates flaws and downplays strengths. Underlying these distortions are self-defeating beliefs, SDBs, that make us vulnerable to anxiety. These include perfectionism, I must never make mistakes, achievement addiction, my worth depends on my accomplishments, approval addiction, I need everyone's approval to feel worthwhile. These beliefs create rigid rules for happiness that are impossible to fulfill. Burns illustrates this with Jeffrey, an attorney devastated after losing a court case. Terrified his colleagues would lose respect for him, Jeffrey was shocked when he finally admitted his failure. 5 attorneys barely noticed, while the other 5 opened up about their own failures, creating genuine connection. Jeffrey discovered what Burns calls the acceptance paradox. His perceived weakness became his greatest strength, allowing him to connect authentically with others for the first time. While changing your thoughts is powerful, Burns offers 2 additional models that approach anxiety from different angles. The exposure model works by confronting fears directly rather than changing thoughts. When you're anxious, you're always avoiding something. By facing what you fear most, you defeat your anxiety. Burns shares his personal experience overcoming a blood phobia during medical school. By volunteering in a trauma center emergency room and forcing himself to scrub gunpowder from a bombing victim's wounds, he experienced flooding, intentionally exposing himself to his fear until his anxiety burned itself out. After 10 minutes of sheer panic, his anxiety suddenly vanished and he was cured of his blood phobia, even developing a love for emergency medicine. The hidden emotion model offers yet another perspective. Anxiety often masks emotions we don't want to acknowledge, particularly anger. Burns calls anxiety the niceness disease because anxious people typically suppress negative feelings to maintain harmony. This was true for Brent, a beloved high school teacher hospitalized for panic attacks after his wife announced her pregnancy. Despite desperately wanting children, Brent had violently slashed a bean burrito, then feared he might be a potential murderer. Through analysis, Burns uncovered that Brent was experiencing normal ambivalence about fatherhood. While genuinely wanting a child, he worried about balancing his already demanding 60-hour teaching schedule with new parental responsibilities. When Brent finally opened up to his wife about his concerns, she wasn't upset at all. She was relieved he was finally communicating. His anxiety disappeared completely, and he was discharged that same day without spending a night in the hospital. These three approaches, changing thoughts, confronting fears, and uncovering hidden emotions, provide a comprehensive toolkit for defeating anxiety. Different techniques work for different people, requiring persistence and experimentation to find what works best. Despite pharmaceutical companies' persistent marketing claims that anxiety and depression result from chemical imbalances requiring medication, Burns forcefully challenges this widely accepted narrative. Drawing on his extensive research background, including winning the prestigious A.E. Bennett Award for Psychiatric Research from the Society of Biological Psychiatry, Burns reveals that despite decades of studies and billions in research funding, he found no compelling scientific evidence that serotonin deficiency or any other chemical imbalance causes depression or anxiety. In a landmark multi-university NIH study comparing St. John's wort, Zoloft, and placebo treatments across 8 weeks, the results were striking and counterintuitive. The placebo group actually had higher recovery rates, 32%, than either Zoloft, 25%, or St. John's wort, 24%. This finding aligns with Dr. Irving Kirsch's comprehensive meta-analysis of FDA data, which showed that 75 to 80% of antidepressant effects come from placebo response. Using the standardized Hamilton rating scale for depression, patients on antidepressants improved by approximately 10 points, while placebo patients improved by 8 points, meaning the actual drug effect was merely 2 points on a scale where 25 points would represent full recovery. This minimal difference raises serious questions about the cost-benefit ratio of these medications. Many antidepressant studies suffer from serious methodological flaws that compromise their validity. In supposedly double-blind trials, patients can easily determine whether they're receiving the actual medication or placebo based on noticeable side effects like dry mouth, sexual dysfunction, or sleep changes. Those experiencing side effects become more hopeful, believing they're getting the real treatment, while those without side effects feel discouraged, creating a significant expectancy effect that skews results. Drug companies could address this by using active placebos that mimic medication side effects, but marketing priorities and profit motives often clash with scientific integrity. Additionally, pharmaceutical companies frequently conduct multiple trials but only publish those showing positive results, creating publication bias. More troubling still, Dr. David Healy's comprehensive research found suicide rates nearly 3 times higher in adults taking SSRI antidepressants compared to those on placebos, a finding that sparked major controversy and led to black box warnings. While medications can undoubtedly help some individuals with severe depression, anxiety, or serious disorders like schizophrenia, Burns argues they should ideally be combined with evidence-based cognitive behavior therapy and aren't usually necessary for long-term treatment. He emphasizes that many patients can achieve lasting recovery through psychological techniques alone, particularly those with mild to moderate symptoms. The key is understanding that while medication may provide temporary relief, addressing underlying thought patterns and behaviors often leads to more sustainable improvement. Burns also points out that the chemical imbalance theory originated largely from marketing rather than science, as pharmaceutical companies sought a simple explanation to promote their products. This oversimplified model has inadvertently led many people to believe their emotional struggles are purely biological, potentially undermining their sense of agency in recovery. Why do we cling to anxiety despite its misery? The answer lies in understanding anxiety's hidden benefits. Using a technique called cost-benefit analysis, Burns helps patients uncover these advantages. For Sam, who developed PTSD after being robbed at gunpoint, anxiety made him feel vigilant and protected, while his anger preserved his sense of pride. However, when weighing these benefits against the disadvantages, constant misery, wasted energy, Sam realized the costs outweighed the benefits 70-30. Similarly, Eileen forgot her homework assignments and eventually admitted she might prefer staying anxious and depressed. Her list of advantages to remaining miserable included getting attention from her husband, avoiding housework and job hunting, playing the victim role, justifying her drinking, and feeling special. The disadvantages of recovery included having to work hard on assignments, stop drinking, do housework, look for a job, and give up feeling special. This resistance to change explains why many people remain stuck despite their suffering. The daily mood log helps overcome this resistance by identifying and changing thoughts that trigger anxiety and depression. This 5-step process involves 1. Describing an upsetting event, 2. Circling and rating emotions from 0 to 100%, 3. Identifying negative thoughts and rating belief in them, 4. Identifying cognitive distortions in each thought, and 5. Challenging each negative thought with more positive, realistic thoughts. The process demonstrates how all your problems are embedded in specific moments of distress, and solving those moments provides solutions to all your problems. For example, Marsha, a therapist who constantly worried about her 26-year-old daughter Leslie, discovered her anxiety was actually connected to unresolved guilt about another daughter, Elisa, who had died from complications of hydrocephalus. When Marsha challenged her belief that she was responsible for Elisa's death, her anxiety about Leslie decreased dramatically, allowing her to finally grieve properly. Self-defeating beliefs, SDBs, explain why some people are more vulnerable to anxiety than others and why different people struggle with different issues. These beliefs follow formulas like, I need X to feel happy and fulfilled, or create expectations about relationships that lead to conflict. The downward arrow technique helps identify these beliefs by starting with a negative thought and repeatedly asking, if this thought were true, why would it upset me? Following this chain reveals your underlying beliefs. Like Rashid, who feared failing his pilot exam, this process exposed his perfectionism, approval addiction, and achievement addiction, beliefs that created unnecessary anxiety despite his excellent academic standing. Changing these beliefs involves 3 essential steps. First, perform a cost-benefit analysis to evaluate whether the advantages outweigh the disadvantages of holding the belief. Second, revise the belief to preserve its benefits while eliminating its drawbacks. Finally, test the belief through experimentation to transform intellectual understanding into emotional change. Nate, an accomplished medical professor who felt perpetually inadequate, discovered this when he used the pleasure-perfection balance sheet to test his perfectionism. His prestigious lecture with a 90% perfection rating and 30-second standing ovation gave him only 20% satisfaction, while fixing a broken pipe with just 5% perfection brought him 100% satisfaction, the most fulfilling experience he'd had in years. This experiment showed him that his belief, if I can't do something perfectly, it's not worth doing, was completely false. He realized he'd overlooked countless sources of satisfaction, like walks with his wife or playing squash with his son. For love addiction, the belief that I can't feel truly happy or fulfilled without love, the revised belief might be, it's not wise to rely on someone else for happiness or worth. My neediness may sabotage relationships. While loving relationships are wonderful, activities I do alone can be extremely rewarding too. Testing this belief involves comparing satisfaction levels between solo activities and social ones, often revealing that many solo activities bring unexpected joy. Burns provides an arsenal of techniques to challenge the thoughts that fuel anxiety. The What If technique uncovers the terrifying fantasies behind anxiety by repeatedly asking, "What if this were true? What's the worst thing that could happen?" until you reach the core fear. For Kristen, this revealed her fear that if she walked alone, she might drop her handkerchief, a murder could happen at that spot, police might find her DNA, and she could be imprisoned for life. When explored deeper, her real fear emerged. She worried about her son's behavioral problems and felt guilty about not disciplining him properly. The double standard technique helps overcome self-criticism by treating yourself with the same compassion you'd show a friend. Walter, a marriage and family therapist, devastated by his partner's departure, discovered he would never speak so harshly to someone else as he did to himself. When he applied the same compassionate reasoning to himself, his belief that he was impossible to live with dropped completely as he realized he'd maintained a successful relationship for 8 years. Truth-based techniques examine evidence for negative thoughts or test their validity through experiments. Emily, a musician terrified of flying, feared being trampled to death by panicking passengers. When asked to recall instances of plane tramplings in aviation history, she couldn't name any. The experimental technique involves actively testing negative thoughts through real-world experiments. Kim, with a driving phobia, tested wet hands on the steering wheel, checked for hand moisture while driving, changed lanes to test car control, and even jumped on the Golden Gate Bridge to test its stability. These experiments revealed her fears were unfounded. June, a 71-year-old woman with agoraphobia since age 18, feared being alone because she might crack up and go crazy. After 53 years of unsuccessful treatments, Burns challenged her to deliberately try going crazy in his office. When she hesitated, he demonstrated first, lying on the floor, flailing wildly, shrieking, and banging his head against the wall. June then tried herself, initially timidly, but eventually throwing herself into a full performance of insanity. Afterward, she had a profound realization. I've just discovered that I can't crack up, no matter how hard I try. Her depression and anxiety scores immediately dropped to zero, and her agoraphobia disappeared completely. Almost everyone feels shy or awkward sometimes, but for some people, these feelings can damage self-esteem, hinder careers, and prevent intimate relationships. Shyness stems from distorted thoughts that create self-consciousness and anxiety in social situations. These negative thoughts act as self-fulfilling prophecies. When you believe others won't like you, you become anxious and self-absorbed, making genuine connection impossible and creating the very rejection you feared. The smile and hello practice proved transformative for Roger despite his initial resistance. After Burns and his wife firmly insisted he try the technique, Roger experienced a breakthrough. To his surprise, people responded positively to his greetings, leading to animated conversations and complete elimination of his shyness. Years later, Roger reported his social anxiety was ancient history. He had become socially confident, enjoyed dancing, and developed a fulfilling romantic life. Flirting training helps shy people develop social skills they never learned naturally. Burns explains that effective flirting involves making others feel special through lighthearted compliments, playful teasing, and positive body language. The key insight is treating flirting as a fun game rather than something serious. When people sense you're playing affectionately without neediness, they respond positively. Burns taught Anne-Marie, a lonely teacher, to give slightly insincere compliments tailored to different personality types and to maintain the upper hand by not appearing too interested. After role-playing and overcoming her concerns about looking desperate, Anne-Marie successfully flirted with men on her train ride, even receiving a date invitation. Rejection practice involves deliberately seeking rejection to overcome fear of it. Burns shares how Dr. Albert Ellis asked 200 women for dates in 2 weeks. Nearly all rejected him, but he conquered his fear. Burns and his friend Spider had similar experiences approaching women in Palo Alto and San Francisco. Though they were shot down every time due to being nerdy and desperate, they overcame their fears of rejection, which became the foundation for developing more fulfilling social lives. Self-disclosure involves openly acknowledging feelings of shyness or nervousness rather than hiding them. Burns illustrates this with a personal story about feeling intimidated in a wealthy neighbor's mansion and simply admitting it, which led to friendship. The technique works because shame, not shyness, is the real enemy. Joseph, a Harvard graduate who was brilliant but socially awkward, resisted this approach until finally trying it with a secretary he was attracted to. When Joseph admitted his shyness, she responded enthusiastically, saying she'd been looking for a sensitive man.
When we suppress problems or feelings to avoid upsetting others, anxiety often emerges as a substitute for assertiveness, Burns explains that approximately 75% of anxious patients are sweeping some obvious problem under the rug. When these issues are addressed directly, anxiety typically disappears. Terry's first panic attack occurred during a vacation in Jamaica when she discovered that another couple expected her and her husband to pay for their entire trip. Though shocked and upset, Terry was too nice to express her feelings. Instead, she began hyperventilating, felt dizzy with chest pain, and blurted, "I think I'm about to die." The group rushed to a medical clinic, then flew back to the U.S., ruining their vacation. Burns explains that Terry's symptoms indirectly communicated, "I won't pay," and "You ruined my vacation, so I'll ruin yours," without her having to confront anyone. Marcy, a 71-year-old woman, suffered from chronic worrying for over 50 years. She constantly imagined her two sons dying in California hiking accidents and her husband collapsing from heart attacks. Through the hidden emotion technique, Burns discovered Marcy was harboring unexpressed anger toward her family. She disliked her son's new wives, but didn't want to seem like the wicked witch. More surprisingly, despite claiming a perfect 50-year marriage, Marcy had never once expressed anger toward her husband, having been taught that loving couples should never argue. Her worrying fantasies were actually disguised expressions of anger. She was symbolically killing off her family members while maintaining her role as the innocent, loving wife and mother. Corey, a pathology resident, sought treatment for OCD that threatened his career. After a piece of cadaver spinal column flew into his eye during an autopsy, he developed extreme contamination fears despite knowing the cadaver died from a heart attack. His ritualistic preparation, wearing double gowns, gloves, and even a NASA space helmet, took over an hour before each procedure. Though Corey initially insisted everything in his life was fine except for his OCD, the truth eventually emerged. He hated pathology, a career his father had chosen for him. He'd always wanted to be an emergency room doctor. After applying for and receiving an ER position at another hospital, Corey's contamination fears vanished completely. When confronting anxiety, you now have numerous tools at your disposal, over 40 techniques across cognitive, exposure, and hidden emotion approaches. The challenge is determining which will work for your specific situation, as the effective technique is often unexpected and varies between individuals with similar anxiety types. The Recovery Circle method helps you systematically find what works for you. After completing a daily mood log, place your most troubling negative thought in the center of a recovery circle. Then select at least 15 different techniques from the 40 ways to defeat your fears list and write one in each box around the circle. This approach acknowledges that most techniques you try won't work. You'll typically need to attempt 10 to 15 before finding the effective one. The goal is to fail as fast as you can to discover what actually helps. Helen, an accomplished electrical engineer with a PhD from MIT, developed body dysmorphic disorder after a minor injury to her nose during an earthquake. Despite the wound healing completely, she became convinced there was an ugly scar on her nose. Her obsession prevented her from leaving the house during daylight, fearing people would stare in disgust. Multiple techniques were attempted, including the double standard technique and response prevention. The downward arrow technique revealed several destructive beliefs: perfectionism, perceived perfectionism, approval addiction, fear of rejection, the spotlight fallacy, and the brush fire fallacy. These beliefs, not any actual flaw in her appearance, were fueling her anxiety. The breakthrough came when Helen courageously tested her beliefs by going to a Beverly Hills shopping center and smiling at 20 strangers, tracking their responses. 15 people responded positively, 5 neutrally, and none negatively. When she repeated the experiment without makeup the next day, she was shocked that people remained friendly. Helen took an even bolder step by dressing outrageously in a purple feathered hat, red dress, Mardi Gras beads, and sequin shoes. Surprisingly, people were even friendlier than before. Her fears about her nose completely disappeared. There's a critical difference between feeling better, when anxiety or depression disappears, and getting better, having tools to deal with these feelings for life. After recovery, relapse is 100% certain, not just possible, but inevitable for all humans. The difference between those who suffer chronically and those who don't is that some people get stuck in bad moods while others know how to break free quickly. The solution is preparing for relapse ahead of time by creating a relapse daily mood log while you're feeling good. By identifying the negative thoughts you might have during a relapse and developing positive responses in advance, you'll be ready to combat them when they inevitably arise. This preparation can prevent temporary setbacks from becoming prolonged episodes of depression or anxiety. Remember that anxiety often signals that something's bothering you beneath the surface. Instead of fixating on symptoms like worry or panic, ask yourself if you're angry with someone or if something upsetting has happened recently. By identifying and addressing these underlying emotions and problems, your anxiety will typically disappear. Each time anxiety surfaces, it will signal that you're upset with someone but haven't expressed your feelings. Once you address the problem, your negative feelings will disappear again.